Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and here we are. Time for our last Larry Mueller Show book club selection of the year. I've mentioned this before, but I'll mention it again. When we look at books for the year, we look for authors who may reside in Wisconsin. We look for books that relate to Wisconsin, one or the other, or both. And this year, we're lucky to have both with our guest author, Mary Behan. Mary's a retired professor of neuroscience. She writes fiction, memoir, and short stories. She lives in a historic cabin near Mazamani, and we're going to certainly hear more about that cabin. I have some ties to it as well. And her book is titled A Measured Threat. And it is a lovely book. As we talk with her, I want to hear from you. Have you read A Measured Threat or some of Mary's other work? What'd you think about it? Maybe you migrate to Wisconsin, and maybe you want to talk about how you've made this place your home. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Mary Behan, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
I'm delighted to be here, Larry.
Well, As I said, I really loved your book. It was, and we'll get into it, but how'd you get the idea? Talk about how you got the idea for A Measured Threat.
Well, I had written a memoir with my sister, who lives in Canada. We wrote about our boarding school days in Ireland, letters back and forth. And when we had published that, that was 2015, it's called Abbey Girls, I sort of felt a bit empty. And I really wanted to write something, and I wasn't too sure what it would be, but I was willing to try. I was retired, and I came across a cache of letters in Ireland at the house I used to live in that were written by me to my parents in Ireland when I first emigrated. Mm. And I thought, now there's a story. You could write about what's between the lines in letters you write home to your parents from your first year in America. So that's where the whole thing started.
And you wrote it during the pandemic, did you not?
No, not this one. This one I wrote before the pandemic. This was published in 2020. I wrote short stories during the pandemic. That was easier. And then afterwards, I wrote a sequel to A Measured Thread called Finding Isabel.
Yeah, I want to get to that, too. You have a background, obviously, wonderful background as a scientist. What was it about fiction that attracted you?
Oh, the freedom. Oh, yeah. My God. You know, when you're a scientist, I've written innumerable papers and grant applications, and you have to be very precise. There's no space for an extra adjective or adverb. But with fiction, you can say anything, and you can create people that you might enjoy meeting.
Does neuroscience, I'm just trying to think if neuroscience actually shows up in the, I guess it does in the story.
I think what shows up is memory, how labile memory is. And in this story, A Measured Thread, as Maggie looks back, sometimes she's not sure if she remembers accurately. And of course, memories change as you revisit them over the years.
What, A Measured Thread, the title, what's the meaning behind it?
Well, I went back to sort of explain it to myself. There's a statue in Dublin. It's on the corner of St. Stephen's Green near Earlsford Terrace, for any of you who know Dublin. And it's three figures posed in, they're the Norns, they're Norwegian deities, and they're very much like the Greek gods. So three women, one young, one middle-aged, and one old. And the young one is spinning the thread of life. The middle-aged one is measuring it. And the old woman, seated, has a large scissors in her hand. And it struck me that it is a metaphor for the story in this book, Maggie O'Connor's story. And I was going to use a picture of it on the cover, but it's a very depressing looking piece of sculpture. And this was a much prettier cover.
Oh, it's a beautiful
cover. It's a local
cover.
Artist, actually. It's an artist from Wanakee. And I saw this piece in our local coffee shop and tracked her down and bought it.
Oh, and it's now hanging in your...
It's hanging in my house, yes.
Well, it's a lovely, lovely color cover. You have a passage. Will you read a passage from the book, just to give listeners an idea of those who haven't read it?
Okay, I'd be delighted to. I'm going to read the second paragraph, for the book opens at a prairie burn, which is very characteristic in Wisconsin. And Maggie O'Connor, the protagonist, she's 79 years of age, she's helping with the prairie burn. Standing at the edge of the prairie, her feet slightly apart, Maggie leaned against her fire swatter, a crude pole topped by a flap of thick black rubber. Glancing down, she considered how inadequate a tool it was in the face of the approaching flames. She reminded herself she wasn't alone. To her left and right was a line of figures, many of them her neighbors, each of them alert and patient. A few carried fire swatters. Others were better armed, with backpack water pumps that weighed at least 50 pounds. In the early years, she too had carried a water pack, but those days were long gone. Had she chosen to watch the burn from the safety of her cabin, no one would have cared. But she was determined to play her part. After all, it was her prairie. 30 years ago, she had taken an exhausted cornfield and transformed it into a kaleidoscope of color that changed with the seasons and over the years. When possible, she walked its perimeter, admiring its subtle beauty. That was her reward for being a good steward of her adopted home.
Lovely. The first paragraph of the book really captured my attention right away because I thought, oh, she's in a fire. But I like the that there's a thread of this running through the book of saving the land and honoring the land that I really liked.
Yes, and I feel very much that way about where I live. I am a temporary steward, and the stewards before me were wonderful, and I hope the ones after me are as good.
Yeah. Well, you're talk some more about Maggie O'Connor, the main character.
Maggie is 79. She emigrated from Ireland in her mid-20s and eventually came to work at the University of Wisconsin as a professor. When she first came to America, she went to University of Massachusetts in Amherst. That was her first year. And then she went to Germany for 5 years thereafter, finally returning to the States. She's widowed. She has no children. She's retired, and she loves where she lives. And she wants life to go on like that forever. But she has an accident and falls down her basement stairs. And life suddenly changes radically as she recognizes that she can't do everything.
Herself, yeah. Well, you emigrated from Ireland yourself at, I think you, what, 25 years old, something like that?
Yeah.
What other similarities do you share?
You know, it's funny.
Because she's kind of flinty. Maggie can be a little
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she has a side to her. And, you know, I went back and read this book. I haven't read it in 7 years. I haven't read it since I wrote it. And I must admit, I was sort of taken aback by how much of me was in this book. Because when I wrote it, I thought, this is a character. She's over there. Nothing to do with me. Just some good background material. And I'm not that flinty. She's a combination of a number of people I've met over the years. But she has a determination that I think all emigrants have to survive and thrive.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering how your own background influenced the story, other than your own experiences. Are there specific Irish authors maybe you can talk about those you might enjoy?
I love Colm Tobin's writing. Mm. But actually, the person I was reading when I was writing this initially was Isabel Allende. I read a lot. And I have a website and I write small one-paragraph commentaries on books that I'm reading. My sister does the same. We share a website, actually, because, you know, she's a scientist. She writes, too. And we use our website in some ways to share what we are reading and what we are writing and our travels and our family backgrounds. It's great fun.
It is great fun. It's great fun, fun reading your book, Measured Thread, for sure. Mary Behan, our guest, retired professor of neuroscience. She writes fiction, memoirs, short stories, and lives in a historic cabin near Mays Maney. And her book is titled A Measured Thread. Questions for her? Maybe you've read the book, or maybe you just have a question for her. Give a call, the number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about our last book club selection for the year, and it's a dandy. It's titled A Measured Thread, and the author is Mary Behan. And I hope you'll join in with your own comments and questions, maybe an experience to share. Again, the number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. The setting of A Measured Thread plays a big role in the story. Tell us about Maggie's land.
Maggie O'Connor lives in a settler's log cabin. It was built in 1854. It's at the base of a sandstone hill and in a valley. She has a big pine tree plantation, a large pond, and she also has a beautiful old log barn. She adores this place, and frankly, I do too, because the setting is exactly where I live. I've added a few embellishments. I've changed a few things, but it's very much the house I bought 41 years ago in Dunlap Hollow.
You know, Brett in Madison has something that relates just to what you're talking about. So let's pull Brett in. Brett, thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Happy, I guess we got through the solstice, so now it's brighter every day. So that's
a good thing.
Just wanted some more information on the house. I did an 1849 farmhouse on Milwaukee Street that was the last stagecoach stop for soldiers going to Camp Randall for the Civil War. It's 1 year younger than the state of Wisconsin, and wanted to hear more about Mary's cabin. It only took me 3 years to get it up to code.
Brett, thanks for calling.
Brett, I have to say I'm still working on it. It'll always be a work in progress. I mentioned in the book that Maggie dealt with flying squirrels. It took me about 35 years to finally get rid of the flying squirrels, which were lovely, but were inclined to appear at night and maybe walk over your face in the bedroom.
Brett, thank you very much for calling. And all the slides we're at, let's go to Mark in Edgerton. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to, really, a double-sided question, that is, where can one get Mary Behan's books, and where might she be giving a talk about her books? I have not read her books. I am listening to her and wish I had. I think her language is just extraordinary, and she reminds me very much of a favorite Scottish author of mine named Dorothy Dunnett, who passed away many years ago but wrote wonderful historical fiction. And anyway, I love her. The sound of her books just sounds great, and I'd like to know more.
All right.
Okay, well, you can always order any of my books from your local bookstore. If you go to my website, mvbehan.com, on the front page will be the four books that I have. And I encourage you to go to your local bookstore. But of course, you can always go to the other large bookstore in the sky, and they're there as well. And if you like listening to them, three of the books are audiobooks. So you can get them from Audible or wherever you get your audiobooks. I voiced them. And for the memoir, my sister and I together did the recording. We had great fun.
I bet you did. Mark, thank you very much for calling. You took a question I needed to ask at some point. I'm glad you came in and reminded me to ask that question. Oh, my gosh. Well, the cabin, I've got to bring this up. It was known as the Mealer Cabin. And my grandfather, Elmer Mealer, his brother was Lawson Mealer. And Lawson Mealer kind of came to the house from my, great-great-grandfather, I'm thinking? And
yeah.
Then before that, great-great-great-grandfather. And so... For me, and I started reading it without, in the back of my head, I was reading about this cabin. I think, boy, this sounds like a cabin that I spent a few years at, or not years, but days at over the years when I was a very young man, when my grandpa and grandma, Elmer and Nina Mealer, would go to visit Lawson and Goldie, who were the owners of the property at the time. And I can remember climbing that cliff outside the house and worried about rattlesnakes.
I can assure you there aren't any rattlesnakes. Though when I first bought the place, my neighbor shot a rattlesnake off the hillside. So you were being told the truth. My husband is an historian, and he has collected a lot of information about the cabin, but it was a family from Switzerland who came to the United States in 1854 and built the cabin that summer with logs off the land. And you have to think how incredibly hard that must have been. It took them 54 days to get, as far as I know, from Chicago to Dunlap Hollow, driving an oxen and a cart. And it's not a pretty log cabin,
no,
but it was functional.
And it was two stories.
Right, which was unusual. And it had a root cellar in the basement. And then they added on, I think, a kitchen, still a log structure. And they added on several years later another room. And Lawson and his wife moved into that, and their son lived in the main cabin.
Roy.
But there were a lot of children born in that cabin, and people died in that cabin. It has great ghosts, if it has them.
And I remember sleeping in that cabin and going to the lilacs.
Going to the lilacs was a euphemism for going to the outhouse, because it was positioned in a grove of lilacs, which it's not there anymore. But I always thought that was a great euphemism.
Marilyn in Middleton, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Larry.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Oh, well, I was a landlady, Mary Behan's landlady on St. Cyr Road, so many years ago, I think when she first came to Madison about. So I just wanted to call in and say hello, Mary. I'm really glad to hear you.
Marilyn Jacobson, I remember you well. And I have to tell you that the book I'm writing right now, it's The Cabin I Lived In on Your Property features in the current story.
Ah.
It's lovely to hear from you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so it's a delight to hear you.
Marilyn, thank you very much for calling. And you can join in, too. Maybe you've got an experience to share or a question to ask about the writing. I hope you will join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. The cabin, I think, was always kind of a gathering place.
Yes. And I was looking at some old newspaper records before coming on air about basically, it seems like they had lots of potlucks. Neighbors came regularly to visit. And there's, you know, it was something that featured in the cabin, that it was a place where people could always come, gather, visit, and feel they were welcome. And I hope that I continue that tradition.
I think you do. And certainly it appears in the book, because when you think about the neighbors, there's a very closeness in that community.
Yes. And there has to be, or there had to be in the past too, because who did you rely on but your neighbors? It really is quite far from Madison. It's 20 miles. And so, you know, who do you have? Oh, and besides, there isn't very good cell service in the valley either.
The reader gets to see Maggie's cabin through all seasons, which was nice. Are those same joys that you feature in the book?
Oh, yeah. I'm very conscious of the seasons. And actually, I write a newsletter on the solstice and the equinox and post it to as many people as want to read it. It's just a page, and it's about my writing. But I think when you live in the country and live in a house like this, you can't avoid the seasons. I mean, it does have heating. Parts of it have air conditioning. But inevitably, you are not feeling a perfect 72 degrees at all times, day and night. There are times when you're frozen, and there are times when you are definitely too hot.
Well, Maggie, the character, 80 years old, I think, or thereabouts. And Maggie is taking scope of her life, kind of weighing her successes and regrets. Talk about what she was proud of.
I think Maggie was proud of making her way in a new world and becoming a successful professor at a university. I think she was glad of her mother's advice, get a job with a pension when you emigrate. I think she was very proud of finding this property and looking after it, being a caretaker and a steward. She was proud of sowing a prairie. You know, she could have left it in corn and taken the rent off it. So I think these are elements of Maggie. Her relationship with the young woman who comes to help her, Isabel, changes over the course of the book. Initially apprehensive and resentful of needing someone, and then becoming close to this young woman and recognizing something she lost, because she didn't have children of her own, didn't have a grandchild, and she came to look upon Isabel as a grandchild. And at some point during the book, Isabel rejects her. And that too is a shock for her, but there is a reconciliation.
Yeah. She had many painful memories that she buried.
Yes.
Why do you... why do people like Maggie often bury their past?
I don't want to sort of give away the big secret in this book, because Maggie has kept a secret for well over 50 years, and eventually it comes out. But I think I think it's easy for you to push aside something traumatic in your life. But as you grow old, there's space for it to be recovered and reanalyzed, and a space for you to forgive yourself.
Yeah. David in Cross Plains has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, David.
Hi. I just wanted to call and mention to Mary, I think I told her the story many years ago, but my grandmother was born in the valley over the hill from the Mueller cabin. And I believe she was the fifth of five girls. And when the son was born, the mother died in childbirth, and leaving the father with five young girls to take care of. And he had no one in the home to do that. So in the summertime especially, I believe, and maybe year-round, he sent them up over the hill and into the next valley, down to the Mueller cabin. And the Muellers took care of those girls during the day, and then would send them back over the hill at the end of the day to be reconnected with the father, and he would spend the evening with them and put them to bed. And they had nothing but I remember my grandmother having nothing but good things to say about the Muellers, but I didn't know a whole lot about them, but I thought they were childless, but maybe not. Maybe they had children of their own, and I'm not even sure. It must have been the Lawson Mueller family that took care of them, but this would have been back in the early days of the 19th or 20th century.
Yeah. What a cool story.
That's a wonderful story. Yeah.
It kind of goes to, I'm thinking back to who those folks were, and they were very kind and loving people.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't surprised me in a way that that's something they would have done.
Well, that story resonates with me because in A Measured Thread, the character Vic, in some ways he was adopted by Maggie's husband while her husband was alive, a challenged and difficult young boy who used to come and fish in the pond. And he spent hours with Maggie's husband, someone who had time for him and would listen to him, would have been the equivalent of a grandfather, but a kind person.
Very kind person. And I'm getting some notes here to please repeat the name of the book again and Mary's name. Mary Behan, and her last name is spelled B-E-H-A-N, Mary Behan. And her book is titled A Measured Thread, A Measured Thread. A lovely, lovely book. So well written. How many, by the way, just as an aside, how many rewrites did you go through? These words that you put together are just marvelous. But I know, having done a lot of writing myself, that it can be almost painful sometimes.
I think the first pass is always the most fun, because you're telling a story. And when you get to the end and you write the end, you just feel great. And you can put it aside, because you're always told, put it aside for 4 to 6 weeks and then read it again. And it's the next 12 or 15 passes through it that are the challenge. I had a really good editor. Christine Collini in New Glarus was an editor for my first book, Abbey Girls, and she has continued to be my editor. And she's very kind, but she's also
brutal.
Capable of saying, you know, you were a bit indulgent in that last 40 pages. Maybe you could cut it down a bit.
To 20 or something.
Right.
Well, the result was it was the 2020 best indie book.
Yeah.
Name.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty nice.
Oh, it was lovely. It's like getting a star on your forehead in school.
Oh, man. Well, what one theme that appears in the book is expectations for Irish women. Back then, you were expected to settle down in your hometown and start a family. Maybe you could talk more about women in Irish Catholic culture.
So I was fortunate. I had wonderful parents. I went to a great boarding school for my 6 years, from age 11 to 17. And that's what my sister and I wrote about in Abbey Girls. We wrote letters back and forth to each other. We were in our 60s at that time. And we just said, do you remember? And we would contradict each other on what we remembered, even though we were in the same place at the same time, 150 girls and 300 nuns in the convent. It was, but I got a fantastic education. So we both went to university, we both went into science, and I got a PhD in zoology from University College Dublin. And after that, you came to a full stop, because there weren't jobs for women scientists in Ireland. This would have been in 1967, and it was unusual enough to get a PhD in science for a woman. But after that, there was no career prospect. You always heard, you better go away and get experience. And that meant going to England or Europe or America to do a postdoctoral fellowship. And then what? Would there be a job in Ireland for you? Unlikely, because men got jobs, because men traditionally would marry, have children, and need to support them. And for a woman who wanted to continue working in science, she'd probably end up being a technician in a laboratory owned by the state or the university. But she wouldn't be able to have her own research career. And that's what America gave me.
Yeah. Well, for Maggie, she did not like these expectations about staying home and settling down.
Right. And, you know, so I put Maggie in the zoology department at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, not too far from the neuroscience community. But she had a great career, you know, in Wisconsin. And I wanted to showcase that because it was such a contrast to what would have been her fate in Ireland. However, I enabled my protagonist to consider what she missed out on when she didn't have a family and a traditional Irish life, because families are at the core of Ireland. I mean, when I go back now to Ireland, I'm amongst women who are telling me all about their grandchildren and this marriage and that funeral, perhaps. But it's very much concentrated on family. And I wanted Maggie to reflect that you make choices and that you cannot necessarily have it all.
Mordecai emailed us. He wonders if there's an ecosystem or place in Ireland or anywhere else you've lived or called home that has influenced you, Mary, and lit the fire of land stewardship for you. And would you think of Maggie's Prairie to be a character of its own in the book alongside with Maggie?
That's a lovely question. And I definitely think that the land, the cabin, the barn, and the prairie and the pond are a character equal in some ways to all the other characters in this book. As for Ireland, a place there, I was brought up on the east coast of Ireland. My family comes from the west of Ireland, from County Mayo, around Castlebar, Westport, Lewisburg, Achill. And when I go back to Ireland, as I do every year and sometimes twice a year, that's where I'm drawn to the west of Ireland. I think Irish emigres feel that it's important to own land, because for generations, Irish people weren't allowed own land when Ireland was owned by England. And so there's that love of country, but you have to own it. Tírgra is the Irish word for it. And once you own a piece of land, you feel secure.
Our guest today, Mary Behan, and her book is titled A Measured Thread. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions and thoughts on the book or just questions in general for her. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with author Mary Behan today about her lovely book. It's titled A Measured Thread. Great to have her with us. And you can join in too at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Let's talk about, you mentioned a couple of the other characters, Vic one, Isabel the other. Isabel, a very key person in this book. I think you mentioned why she comes into Maggie's life, but maybe you could mention that again. But was Isabel inspired by anybody in your personal life?
I think every character in any writer's book is inspired by someone or multiples in their life. And yes, Isabel is a conglomerate, a mixture of four or five students in my life. So when I would describe her, I would, in my mind, have an image of one of these young women. And then as far as her background is concerned, her mother, her adoptive parents, the mother is from New Zealand and the father is from Serbia. And so I know some students who have a New Zealand parent and some students who have a Serbian parent. So as I say, it's a mixture, but it's lovely to have that range of backgrounds amongst your ex-students that you can tap into.
And Maggie and Isabel are similar in some ways and different in others.
I think considering there's an age difference, Isabel is about 25 in A Measured Thread and Maggie is 79 going on 80. So it's almost like back to those three statues, that Isabel is weaving the thread of her life and Maggie is looking at the scissors in anticipation of the end of her life. But they have much in common. You know, Isabel wants to be a successful, happy young woman in her life and career, but she's frustrated because she doesn't like what she's doing, which is she's a school counselor. She got a degree in psychology and she doesn't enjoy her work. And so she is looking to change. Maggie has looked back over her life and thought, you know, you don't have the luxury of just saying, well, I don't like it, I'm not going to do that anymore. And she makes it clear to Isabel she doesn't approve of her, her drive to just be happy. As she said, you had a good job, why would you leave it?
And there's a lot of tension relating to that.
Yes, yes. And their conversations back and forth remind me often of conversations that I've had with my own students. And at the same time, you understand their needs, but you also recognize that life doesn't often give you exactly what you want.
Yeah. As immigrants, and I'm thinking about, as you were mentioning that, I was thinking about my own students, my own graduate students over my career, many of them from other countries. In fact, probably half of them were from other countries. And there were always issues are that often, I shouldn't say always, but often kind of issues just within their own feelings and their own emotions about being there. And as immigrants and women, those for Maggie and Isabel.
Yeah, Maggie, the excitement of being a new immigrant comes across, I think, in Maggie rereading or having Isabel read to her the letters that she wrote when she first came to America. You know, the thrill of it. And then the reality of life taking over and trying to plan for a future when you don't know what's ahead of you. If you're just a postdoc, you don't know whether you will end up going home, back to your country, or whether you will be able to survive and thrive in this new world. Isabel is from Canada, and she is looking to go to veterinary school. I mean, she thinks that's what she'd like to do, but then that's another hill to climb because she doesn't have all the requirements. And so she has to go back to school and take courses and get some experience in the veterinary field. I taught in the veterinary school for 30 years, and I actually went out to two of my ex-students up at the Lodi Clinic and said, can I spend a day with you to see what you actually do?
Oh, wonderful.
Oh, it's great fun.
And for your research, and you were, obviously you go to Ireland anyway.
Yeah, yeah. But no, I spent a half day with each of them, a husband and wife couple. One was an equine veterinarian, the other is a bovine veterinarian. And it was marvelous.
Well, I don't want to spoil too much of the story, but we learn that Maggie hasn't been to Ireland in 25 years. Why was she hesitant to return to Ireland?
Oh, I think if you stay away that long, you don't know what you're going to find when you go home. It's not that the country has changed. Of course it'll have changed. It's just, do you have the same relationship with that dream place that you remember fondly? There's another Irish word, Tírnanog, the land of youth. And it's actually the name on the driveway going up to the cabin. I have a little plaque there. It's how you think back to, I was young there. I had a great life there. I was a student there. And to stay away for 25 years, what are you going to find when you go back? Not so much about the country, but about yourself. And so I have Maggie going back to Westport, to where my own grandparents came from, and wandering the streets and then going to a beach, Old Head, just below Crowpatrick, and sitting and remembering and thinking, looking back on her 80 years.
And I was thinking one of the very powerful for me moments comes when she sits down and talks about her parents and where she thinks she fell down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I took her to Glasnevin Cemetery, which is a huge cemetery on the outskirts of Dublin. My own parents are in Glasnevin Cemetery, and I've visited at times and sat and had a chat with them. And so I let Maggie have a chat with her parents, a different conversation than me with mine, but a very honest one.
Very honest, and it really caused me to think about my own relationship with my own parents, and they were really wonderful people, salts of the earth, as you might say, and thinking about where I could have been a better son. I mean, I think I was an okay son, but where I could have been a better son. And I thought, I think a lot of people, when they read that part, are going to ponder their own relationship with their own families, their own parent, mother and father.
Yeah, yeah.
For me, it turned into a very powerful, I mean, it's a couple of pages, but to me, it turned into a very thought-provoking few moments in my own life, which I was glad for. I was so glad that you had that in your book. Vic, I do want to mention Vic because Vic plays such a role. And you talk about him a little bit. Somebody in your life, again, is this a conglomeration of people?
Vic is a conglomeration of people. And again, I tap students that I've had and assemble them into a single person. Vic is such a good guy. And if you choose to read the sequel, Finding Isabel, Vic is in there too. And he grows during Isabel's journey. But he's the perfect guy to have as a neighbor. He's the perfect boyfriend to have. But he's human as well. And he worries about Maggie a lot. And he wants to take care of her if he could. And she, in turn, loves Vic and wants to make sure that he will take care of her land when she's no longer around.
Yeah. At the end of the book, and I'm not going to say what's at the end of the book, but the last five sentences were a total surprise, and a lovely surprise, I might add. And when I finished the book, I thought, oh, man, I hope she's written. I would love to have heard a follow-up to this book. And then I learned, oh, there is a follow-up with, what's the title? It's about Isabel. It's Finding
Isabel. I have to tell you, Larry, I didn't expect that ending. I was going along with a totally different ending, much more predictable. And I couldn't write that one. So this appeared in my brain somewhere, and it happened quite suddenly. And I had no intention of writing a sequel. I was done. I was exhausted. And so, two or three years later, I thought, Isabel has wormed her way into my brain and I need to write her story.
Well, I'm so glad, and I'm going to stop over at the bookstore and pick up a copy of Finding Isabel, because I really did want to know. I mean, you made me want to know everything that kind of happened afterwards, because I grew to love the, you really grow to love the characters, sometimes warts and all. But it's so lovingly written that it really made me want to take another step and get that copy. And that's been out a little bit. How did this book do?
To be honest, I don't know, because the thing is, I sort of keep track of it. Let me tell you, it's just as well I've had a job with a pension. but I don't track it per se. Lots of people have said to me they liked it. I've gone to various events where I sell books. Sometimes you sell, sometimes you don't. Yeah. A lot of time you just talk to people or encourage them to write their stories.
Yeah, well, you've written a lovely book, Mary, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today and talking about A Measured Thread. Thank you very much.
A complete pleasure.
Mary Behan, the author, and the book A Measured Thread. Lovely book, and I hope you have a chance to read it. I think you're going to enjoy it. We are going to do something next that we're all going to be bothered with or worrying about, and that is our taxes. And another Mary Mellum, will be back with us coming up next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Time to talk taxes with Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. She and her husband, David, have been in the tax business for over 30 years. They serve individuals, they consult other tax professionals, and they teach tax seminars, have taught tax seminars around the country. What questions do you have about filing your taxes? Join the conversation. You can call us at 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. Mary Mellum, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. Merry Christmas, and it's a wonderful season.
It is indeed. And taxes are due in April. What should you start thinking about, or why maybe should you be thinking about them now?
Well, there are a few things that people can do before the end of the year. Most specifically, charitable contributions. And before December, on or before December 31st, charitable contributions made, if you itemize this year, it's a good time to do that. You can do charitable, what we call qualified charitable distributions, money from your IRA directly to the charity that would help lower your income. But it's getting close. You'd be happy to talk to your financial planner and make sure that that delivery can happen before the end of the year.
Yeah.
Also, paying property taxes before the end of the year might be a good idea, but with some of the changes for next year, it may be better to leave them off this year and pay them after the first of the year. So lots of things to think about before the end of the year.
Darn, I already paid my property taxes in December. Why would it have been good for me, perhaps, to have waited?
Well, I think most people are aware that there was a tax. There was a piece of legislation, part of which was tax, that was passed by Congress on July 4th of this past year. And it has provisions that both affect 2025 and 2026. But the ones that begin with 26 could be things like the standard deduction. Well, a lot of those things, I should say, those things happen this year. And so preparing, it's too late this year to pay double property taxes. And we have an increased, what we call SALT limitation. So on the tax portion of your Schedule A, we were limited to $10,000 maximum between sales tax, withholdings, property taxes, all of the state tax kind of things. Last year, we were limited to $10,000. Because of the tax legislation passing, that number goes up to $40,000 for 2025 and 26. Well, for a few years after that as well. But looking at this year, you'll be able to take a larger deduction. Some people used to double up on their property taxes, but we didn't know about it when you paid your 24 taxes, so you couldn't do that. So next year is the first opportunity to double up on the property taxes, so to speak.
Got it. Well, maybe one question more before we go to Jason in Madison and John in Madison and some others who are calling in. What are the most common ways you see people confused about their taxes? Or what are the most common problems and solutions people run into as they do their taxes?
Well, making sure that they have all the documents to report all of their income properly. And the documents typically don't come out until the end of January. So getting all of those things together, deciding who your dependents are, if in fact you have dependents, and then putting all of that stuff together. Those are, you know, probably where you start with it. And then when people have unusual situations, it just depends on what that situation is, where you have to go from there.
Jason in Madison, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Yes. Hi. Sorry. I made a charitable, qualified charitable donation in 2025, and I'm wondering out of my IRA, and I'm wondering how I report that.
That's a very good question, Jason. When you get your 1099-R this year, it will tell the total amount that came out of your IRA account. The amount that went directly to charity that you did not receive is a subtraction from that amount. So in the, I believe it's 14A box, you'll have the gross amount. In 14B, you'll put the number after you subtract what you sent directly to charity.
And the part that you send back to, or that you sent to charity, does that then not turn up on your total income?
That is correct. The amount that went directly from the account to the charity. Remember, you can't get the money and then give it to the charity and use this QCD treatment. So it had to go directly from your account to the charity, not to you and then the charity. And you do not pay taxes on the amount that you sent to charity. Now, it's if you got the money and sent it to charity, you'd still get a deduction for it if you itemize. But this way, you get a deduction kind of right off the top. It lowers your adjusted gross income for other purposes, and it's a cleaner way of doing it. It could be a little bit more advantageous to do it that way than itemizing, and certainly if you don't have enough to itemize, then you don't have a benefit of that in 2025. The other thing that's important, this year the 1099-Rs have changed to include a box for QCD, and the tax return, the 1040, has a check box on the front of it where you check the box to indicate that it is a QCD, and that's why the difference between the 1099-R and what you're putting on and being taxed at.
Darren had emailed us. He's $35,000 in overtime this year he received. How much will this increase his refund?
The overtime, first of all, if he had $35,000 in overtime?
Yeah, $35,000.
Wow. Overtime is a little confusing this year. I mean, it's confusing to people because this information says all of my $35,000 is a deduction up to, and the overtime deduction is maxed at $12,500 for an individual. And again, with that, there are income limitations too. As a single person, it's $150,000 modified adjusted gross income, $300,000 for your joint owners. But it's not the $35,000 chances are that is his deduction. Chances are, unless the employer has told you exactly, it's the premium. If you're paid time and a half, your premium is about one-third of that $35,000. And the deduction based on that would be one-third of $35,000 or the $12,500, whatever that is, and you multiply that by your tax rate, and then that's how you're going to see it. So if I were to take $35,000 and divide it by three, that would be $11,666. And if you're in, let's say, the 22% tax bracket, that's going to mean about just over $2,500 extra refund.
All right.
So it is meaningful, but you need extra information to come to the right number.
John in Madison, your turn. Thanks, John, for calling.
And thank you for taking my call. I have two rather simple questions, I believe. Number one, what are the tax rates and what are the amounts of income, whether it be gross or adjusted income?
those rates and where they change.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big question. To give you all of those numbers for this year, the rates go, there are seven tax brackets. They go from 10, they are 10, 12, 22, 24, 32, 35, and 37%. And the rates change. There are different brackets for single, for married filing joint, for head of household, and married separate. And I would strongly suggest that it's best to go to the IRS website or even to Google and ask, type in the 25 income tax rates. And then you'll get the breakdown by filing status for all of those. And just for a couple of numbers to throw out, the 12% bracket is a popular tax bracket. It's the second lowest tax bracket, and the top bracket for a single person, and this is taxable income, goes between $11,925 and $48,475. Now, the joint tax bracket is basically doubling those numbers. So that kind of gives you a little bit of an idea, but if you go on and pull that, you'll get all of the numbers, and you can fit in wherever you are in that category.
Yeah, makes good sense. John, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Linda and Matt in Platteville emailed us. She's a Wisconsin Retirement System recipient, and she's heard some of her pension is not tax-based on a new law passed this year in Wisconsin. Please clarify for Linda and others in the system.
Okay. What she's referring to is a deduction that Wisconsin has created. Actually, it's not a deduction. It is a tax credit, I believe. And Wisconsin this year has a new retirement income subtraction. Not a credit, but a retirement income subtraction, and it applies to your retirement income if you are age 67 or older by the end of the year. The maximum retirement deduction that you can take is $24,000 if you're a single taxpayer and $48,000 if you both are retired and file a joint return. Now, this is huge, but there is an asterisk to it. And what I mean by that is that it's something that you have to weigh what's best for you. Because the offset to it is, if you take advantage of this deduction, you give up your right to take tax credits. And basically, here's what the rule says. The deduction, the cost of the deduction is that no tax credit that is listed in 71.104 of the U.S., of the Wisconsin tax statutes can be claimed. And for a seminar, I pulled up this list. And this list is pretty encompassing. So it's your property tax credit. It's your homestead credit. It's your armed forces credit, your health insurance credit, basically all the credits. You decide, is this deduction enough maybe to wipe out your income more than the credits would give you? So, yes, it exists, and I'm glad that Linda reminded me of it, and it is available to anyone who is age 67 or older that has retirement income, which is different than IRA money, but it's something that you're going to have to decide what's best for me based on your particular situation.
Mary Mellum, our guest, and you can join in too at 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking taxes on the program with Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals, and it's from Green Bay area, and it's certainly great to have her back with us. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Let's turn to Ted in Spooner, Wisconsin. Hi, Ted.
Yeah, hello. I recently got my property tax for in town, and it went up 286%. What can I do to have something done about that? That's crazy.
That is a large increase, 286%.
Now, that's unfortunately not anything to do with income tax as far as changing that, but just a side topic is I would contact your local taxing organization, your county. From what I understand, there is a time period where you can request a look at it or to challenge it. But it's usually there's a certain time frame for that, so I wouldn't put it off too long before I contacted them.
That seems like an almost unbelievable increase. Although mine went up pretty quite a bit myself, and I'm concerned as well in some ways. Ted, but get a hold of your local people and bring it up with them sooner than later. Cheryl in Whitehall, we'll go to you. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi.
And what can we do for you? Cheryl, are you there? Oh, we lost Cheryl, I guess. She'll probably call back. I bet she just had a drop call. Jim in Wausau emailed us. He's read that the IRS treats taxes withheld from required minimum distributions as if they were paid on time quarterly, regardless of when they were made during the year. Is this true? Does Wisconsin treat them similarly?
Any withholding that is taken out of payroll checks, retirement accounts, anywhere, is considered made evenly during the year, even if you have all of the withholding taken out of your very last paycheck of the year. It is different than estimated tax payments where the governing agency, whether it's federal or state, picks it up on the date that they receive it, basically. So the answer to his question is yes. If it is withheld taxes, it will be considered paid timely during the year.
What if it's the required minimum distribution? What if you, let's say in January, you just decide to take the whole required minimum distribution and donate it?
Then there is no withholding. There is no tax on the amount that you donated, so you would be reporting it, but there's no need to have withholding because there wouldn't be anything taxable.
Makes sense. Andy in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Andy.
Hi. I have a question. We file jointly. I'm over 67, so I can claim the $24,000 probably income adjustment credit, but my wife isn't. She's 65, so would neither one of us be eligible for the property tax credit or the married people credits, or because one of us are older, are we eligible for the other credits?
Or do you file jointly, Andy?
We do file jointly.
Yeah.
Andy, I haven't seen any worksheets with it. My guess is if you take the advantage of that deduction, that means that return is singled out from that. So, and I don't know that for sure. That is my educated guess with it. And then the option that I think Larry was kind of thinking about was married filing separate. But in Wisconsin, when you do married filing separate, because Wisconsin is a community property state or a marital property state, you're really taking both of your incomes and dividing it by two. So I would suggest that before you file your tax returns, you do a little bit more looking. I think as we see the instructions to the form and things, there'll be more information for us available than I have right now. This is a relatively new stance for the state. I didn't read anything about it until about October when they announced their new law. So still more information to seek out in that area.
There you go, Andy. Thank you for calling. Bill in Portage, we'll go to you. Hi, Bill.
Hi, this is Bill.
Hi, Bill. What's on your mind?
I'm interested in knowing the capital gains rate for income tax. I know it probably deals with the amount of income plus capital gains income. If she could speak a little bit to that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure. If you're talking, first of all, about federal capital gain rate, your federal capital gain rate is tied somewhat close. There are three rates for capital gains federally. There is a 0% rate, there is a 15% rate, and there is a 20% rate. The 0% rate is linked close to the 12% bracket. So if basically, and the numbers aren't exactly the same, the capital gain rates have their own numbers, but it's close to the 12% rate. So pretty close to, if you're in the 12% bracket, when you add your income plus your capital gain to it, if you stay within that number, and as I mentioned before, for a single person, that's about $48,000. I'm rounding the numbers a little bit. And about $96,000 for married couple. If your taxable income or your income, I should say your income, including your capital gains, is below that, you're not going to pay any capital gain for federal purposes. If your total income goes above that, chances are you're in the 15% tax bracket for capital gains. And so that number multiplied by 15% is what it's going to cost you. And then when you get in the higher tax brackets, I believe it's about the 35% tax bracket, then it becomes taxable at the 20% rate. And that, the 35% rate tops out about $600,000. So you have to, if you sold the farm, so to speak, and made a lot of money in Wisconsin, you could easily be in the 20% tax bracket. But if you're selling stocks and bonds and, you know, just the normal things that we sell, most people are in the 0 or 15% tax bracket.
Bill, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. What if someone dies and they sell, you know, the farm has to be sold and there's, let's say, three people that are going to inherit? What would be would there be some sort of gains, tax gains that the people who receive the money would have to pay?
Okay. That's a fair question. If you inherit property, generally, the property is revalued at the date of death. And if you sell it close to, in a relatively reasonable time after death, there's probably little or no taxes due because your cost basis compared to what you sell it for, there isn't a lot of difference. The difference is what would be taxable. If, on the other hand, mom and dad decided to give you the farm before they died, the difference between what they paid for it and what it's worth at the time they give it to you. That if you sold it after they died and they gave it to you, there would be a much greater chance of paying taxes because they probably paid little in comparison to what it's worth now. So inheritance steps up the basis. Gift prior to death does not have the same effect.
Got it. Jim in Wisconsin Rapids, we'll go to you.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question actually is pretty relevant to what you just discussed, but this is a little different scenario. In the case of a person that he passes away and his widow then has a piece of property and she decides she wants to sell it, let's say in the original purchase was made back in the late 80s and now it's, you know, 2026. So would she be responsible for capital gains from the time of the original purchase on that, or is it calculated based on the time of her spouse's death? So let's say he passed away in 2024, would the capital gains then just be calculated from 2024 to 2026, or does it go all the way back to the original purchase time?
Okay, Jim, I've got a little bit more complication to the situation or questions to ask you. First of all, who owned the property? Whose name was it deeded in?
I think it was in both their names.
Okay. If it's in both their names and we're past the date or it was retitled after Wisconsin became marital property, if all of those things happen, then when he died, the property is revalued for her at its fair market value, even though she's technically a half owner of that property. And if she sold it after he died, she'd probably have little taxes. Now, you need to, in the scenario you described, you need to do a little bit more checking because I believe 1986 is about the year that Wisconsin changed from separate property to marital property. And if it was purchased before that and not retitled, the rules might be that his part gets stepped up and hers doesn't. But you'd have to go back to the search of what really happened with it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Jim, good luck with that search. And on to Elna in Madison. Hi.
Hello. I filed my taxes last year using IRS Free File. I know they've eliminated some of the ways to file. Is that one going to still be available?
I believe so. What they did eliminate was what was called Direct File. Now, Direct File was a program that the IRS paid for or supported itself. It was only around for a year or 2 years. The Free File program is a partnership with the IRS and different software providers. To be honest, I believe that that partnership may still exist. The best way to do is go to irs.gov, type in file taxes, and see what comes up because the links come up through that itself.
Ah, that's a good quick way to find out, Elna. Thank you for calling. And Mark in Wausau, what's on your mind?
About 3 years ago, I had an employer who basically wasn't paying the amount he'd take out of the check. He wasn't paying it in. He wasn't giving us pay stubs. And then the W-2 he made out at the end of the year was completely incorrect, off by thousands. I'm wondering if you have any input on what recourse we have and what we should actually pay on, with the amount that he reported or the amount that I actually made.
Well, the W-2s, if that is the gross amount that he paid you, that's what you have to report. If what it sounds like is he was delinquent on his payroll taxes, which includes any withholding you would have asked for and any Social Security, FICA, and Medicare that's asked for. And that's definitely an issue that the company has with the IRS. If they did not get withholding in your name from that employer, they're probably not going to give you credit for it at that point. But the employer is on the risk for that, and they would go back after him. So on your W-2 that he made at the end of the year, did he tell you how much was withheld?
He reported numbers that, like, what happened was it was like partway through the year, like about October, he stopped giving us the pay stubs and using an excuse why he didn't need to make them. Well, obviously he did need to make them. And then what he reported on, the actual amount, was what he had paid me up to that point. He never included, like, October and November, December. He never even reported it on the W-2.
Oh, so he didn't. So what's on your W-2 is not what you made totally.
Correct.
Okay. Here's another way around that. For you to be the honest person, you should report what's on the W-2. And then there is a form 4137 that says, you know, it wasn't all reported. Here's how much should have been on the W-2. And by the way, here's the withholding tax or the payroll taxes, my half of the Medicare and Social Security that should have been withheld. And you can pay in your part of it and be square with the government. Otherwise, if you don't report all of the income you received, then you're also not filing a correct return. But I would take a look at that form 4137. If he didn't report all of your income to the government, you can't ignore it just because he didn't do the right thing. And I hope that it's just a glitch in his system that he had reported the taxes that were held prior to that. I hope that he didn't just ignore those either. Because when you file the tax return, if things don't agree, the government will send you a letter back saying, we don't have any record of your W-2s. Please send us copies and all kinds of things like that.
Ooh.
That gets messy.
It sounds like a mess. Mark, do the right thing, I guess, is the answer here. Thank you very much for calling. Aaron emailed us. He's looking for tax tips and tricks for freelance workers.
There is the IRS. A freelance worker is basically a Schedule C person. So you're in your own business as an independent contractor. As far as the rules for that, it's the rules that cover a Schedule C person. And the IRS does provide publications for small businesses, for independent contractors. If you're looking for a listing of information, I would go to the IRS website and type in some different words like Schedule C or the type of business that you're in. You know, freelance could be a photographer, it could be a speaker, it could be a landscaper, any of that kind of thing. So whatever that area is in, I would to get help with the idea of what I might have spent or what I could take for deductions, you need to do a little bit of research in that area.
Yeah, makes sense. Tom and Toma, what's on your mind?
Oh, thank you for taking my call. You might have covered the subject already, and I apologize. I recently retired at the end of 2024. In 2025, my mortgage was paid off, and I received an escrow check to pay the property taxes in 2025. before 2025. Should I pay those taxes this year prior to the end of 25, or should I wait till January? So basically, am I doubling up on taxes, paying property taxes?
Yeah.
Here's some things to think about. Without knowing all your numbers, I can't give you a specific answer about it. But one question to ask yourself, did you itemize last year? And if the answer is no, I didn't itemize, how far away from itemizing? How much under the standard deduction were you? And if you weren't able to deduct all of your state taxes last year because of the $10,000 window, and you were relatively close to the standard deduction, not paying them this year would certainly make you take standard deduction in that case. And if you were fairly close, doubling up next year could get you over the top and make it better. So you've got to take a look at your own situation based on maybe your 24 tax return. Look to see if you were close to itemizing. And if you were close but didn't, could those property taxes, doubling them up, get you over the number? And if so, then it would be a good idea.
Yeah, makes very good sense. Tom, take a look. Our guest, Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin, Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Great to have her with us. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Mary Mellum, our guest today, as we talk taxes with her, Mary with Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Tomorrow on the show, George Malara is back to help you decode your dog's behavior. And we'll also talk about the hard work that goes into keeping Wisconsin's roads safe during the winter. Bob emailed us wondering, why is the 10 to 20% bracket jump, the largest increase in the IRS code? That seems like an unfair tax burden for wage earners in that bracket.
Okay, I'm not quite sure what I mean by what he means by the 10 to 20% jump, because the bracket goes from 10% up to 12%, and then, I see where going from the 12% to the 22% bracket is where he's seeing the jump. I can't tell you what the logic is. It's Congress that passed the tax brackets back in 2018 is when we had the change, and the old bracket was the 15% bracket, and it went up to, I believe it went 15 to 22% then. And so I don't know why they widened it. Sure, they had a reason. I don't know what it is.
Karen in Bailey's Harbor emailed, she received a surprise inheritance from a distant German relative. The estate was cashed out, and she is to receive a lump sum. Taxes and fees were taken in Germany. What is her tax obligation in the U.S.?
In the U.S., we are taxable on worldwide income. Now, inheritance oftentimes doesn't enter as a taxable event. It depends on where the inheritance came from. So in the U.S., if I inherit just a bank account that had $100,000 in it, chances are the $100,000 in the bank account is not going to be taxable to me. But if that $100,000 stayed in the bank account for 6 months before the estate was settled and it got to me, what would be taxable to me may be the interest that $100,000 earned in that time period from death to later. That's the easiest way I can explain what she's doing. Now, because it is from Germany, you're still taxable on your worldwide income. Anything that would be taxable basically in the United States, that same idea is going to be taxable even if you get it from a foreign country. The difficult part here is they don't have the same paperwork that we would expect from an inheritance. So she's going to have to find out how much of the money was, or where'd the money come from. If it were a retirement account that somebody didn't pay taxes on it, that could be a taxable event. We call it income in respect of a decedent. But if it's just, you know, an inheritance like, or just a blank sum that she got because it was a specific bequest rather than being in one of a certain number of heirs, that could make it not taxable at all. So there's more to the story before you can get a definite answer.
Yeah. Ron in McHenry, Illinois, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Hello. I have a question that I believe pertains to everybody who gets health care on the marketplace. And this is Form 8962, which is a reconciliation of the payments that you got at the end of the year with what you may owe, or maybe you were overpaid for that. And there's something on here that says SLCSP, which is second lowest cost silver plan. But Mary, what are they doing on this form? Why do they bring in that second lowest cost silver plan and sort of compare it with what you got in advanced payment? What are they saying here? Is that second lowest cost plan sort of give you the maximum headroom that you could exceed your income by and still not owe the money?
First of all, good description of things. The 8962 is the premium assistance tax credit form. And first of all, you get a form from the government called the 1095A. On that 1095A, it tells the information that you need to put on that form. And it says, here's my total premiums for the insurance I've selected. Here's the silver plan numbers. And I use the silver plan number because oftentimes it's less than the actual premium. So you're getting a little bit of a benefit there. And you compare that to what you actually got for a benefit. And the benefit that you got, the subsidy, so to speak, is based on the income you told the people when you signed up for the insurance or renewed it. And that may be totally different than the income that you have. But what your subsidy comes out with is based on your real income. And the difference between the silver plan and what the subsidy you were entitled to is what you get, or what you should have paid. And if you didn't pay enough, that's where you either have to pay some more in, or if you overpaid, then you get some back. But it is a coordination of those numbers. In the upper part, it asks you what your income is and what percentage of the federal poverty level that is. And if you get over 400% of the poverty level in that top part of the form, if that number comes over 400% of the poverty level, then basically you got a subsidy that you didn't deserve, and that's where you have to pay it back. And if your relationship to the poverty level is equal to what you told them, then your subsidy might be perfect, and you get exactly, and, you know, there is no tax consequences.
Ah.
So I don't know if that shortened explanation helps you out, but it can be a complicated matter.
Yeah. Ron, thank you for calling. Joseph in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Joseph.
Hello. I had to get you off speaker. So I was separated a few years back, but we never finalized a divorce. We had had a tax issue where it's fixed now, but we had a back year that was that we were having issues and had to refile. And so we had saved a couple of years, and we were going to do a couple of years at once. And when I went in to do that, I found out from my accountant that my separated or soon-to-be ex-wife had changed all of her W-2 information to get nothing taken out of her taxes, leaving me with, like, thousands of dollars that I owe the IRS. And she's not been responsive to, like, court orders and things to finalize this divorce. So I wonder, is there a way that you can file separated even though you're still married? Is there a way that I can get out of this having to pay for somebody who hasn't lived with me in 3 years and their tax burden? I had always gotten a refund before. I'm a single father of two kids, and now I owe a whole bunch of money for the first time in my life at 46, and I guess I'm just at a loss of what to do.
Okay. First of all, Joseph, have you filed your tax returns in the past, or do you have some returns that you have not filed? I wasn't sure in what you said.
All of my things are filed now.
Okay. So if all of them were filed now, did you file jointly with your ex-wife?
So originally, I think what happened was we filed jointly, then I went in for the meeting to sign, and then I saw the huge amount of money that it said I owed, and then I asked the accountant if it was possible for me to just file separate but still married. He said I could, but then it still shows that I owe not nearly as much as it did before, but like a good couple thousand dollars, and I've always gotten a return before. I don't make that much, and I'm a widowed single father to one child and a divorced single father of another, and I have full custody, and, you know, so I mean,
so
yeah.
Did you file the joint return, or have you not filed that year, or where are you with that year that you just talked about?
I believe he said that he filed it, but then when I got the return back, instead of it saying I owed like $10,000 for both of us, or we did, it said that just I owed a couple thousand dollars. And it's like, well, why should I owe anything? I've never owed money on taxes.
Okay. The reason you might owe something is if you filed separately and you did not live together at all during the year, then you're only responsible for your earnings. But the rules for married separate are a little bit different in the sense that there are some tax benefits that will not help a married separate person. And if that was maybe what happened to your return, it's possible that that's why you see a difference between being a joint return and getting a refund back and getting to take advantage of some of those benefits and not. And it's just, married separate is an alternative, but it's not always the best tax advantage. Certainly there are other reasons for filing married separate, like not being responsible for that other person's numbers. So I think that they probably filed you separate, and it's just the consequences of it. Do your children live with you, or are they older?
No, they live with me.
Okay. Did you talk to him about head of household, or did you have that discussion with him at all?
No.
Because if you don't live together and you have children that are your dependents or qualifying children, you may qualify to be head of household rather than married separate, and that usually helps out a little bit with it. So that, you know, all of that stuff together may be why the numbers aren't the way that you expected them when you were a joint filer.
Oh, and on that note, Mary, we are out of time. Boy, this flew quickly. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to your next visit. Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, her company with her husband David Ashwabanan Tax Professionals. Thank you so much for listening today. It's always a pleasure to be here on WPR News. Big thanks to our whole team for all of the work that they do. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.